turn on, tune in, and drop out.
Johnny Farrow here from the Distract and Disable program. You are listening to WGXC Acra.
Tune in to Quintron's Weather Warlock, a custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizer that turns the changes in the weather into sounds. New Orleans-based artist Quintron installed one of his series of custom-built weather-controlled analog synthesizers in the Wavefarm Study Center, with sensors outside detecting the differences and changes in the weather. Here, the precipitation, the sunlight, the wind, and the temperature turned into soundscapes anytime, 24 hours a day, at wavefarm.org/listen, or click on the listen button at any WGXC.org page. One of the many web streams available to listen anytime, Quintron's Weather Warlock, available through Wavefarm.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, you're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, name of the show, Good Night, Norman. Station you're listening to, WGXC 90.7 FM on your radio dial in beautiful downtown Hudson, New York, Acre, Catskill, Greene and Columbia counties, WGXC.org on the splendiferous, amazing, miraculous, but apparently perfectly organic world wide internet web. Tonight, a sad tale, the classic tale, a famous tale, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish by J.D. Salinger. There were 97 New York advertising men in the hotel, and the way they were monopolizing the long-distance lines, the girl in 507 had to wait from noon till almost 2:30 to get her call through. She used the time, though. She read an article in a woman's pocket-sized magazine called Sex is Fun or Hell. She washed her comb and brush. She took the spot out of the skirt of her beige suit. She moved the button on her Saks blouse. she tweezed out two freshly surfaced hairs in her mole. When the operator finally rang her room, she was sitting on the window seat and had almost finished putting lacquer on the nails of her left hand. She was a girl who, for a ringing phone, dropped exactly nothing. She looked as if her phone had been ringing continually ever since she had reached puberty. With her little lacquer brush, while the phone was ringing, she went over the nail of her little finger, accentuating the line of the moon. She then replaced the cap on the bottle of lacquer and, standing up, passed her left, the wet hand, back and forth through the air. With her dry hand, she picked up a congested ashtray from the window seat and carried it with her over to the night table on which the phone stood. She sat down on one of the made-up twin beds and, it was the fifth or sixth ring, picked up the phone. "Hello," she said, keeping the fingers of her left hand outstretched and away from her white silk dressing gown, which was all that she was wearing, except mules. Her rings were in the bathroom.
"I have your call to New York now, Mrs. Glass," the operator said.
Thank you, said the girl, and made room on the table for the ashtray. Excuse me. A woman's voice came through.
"Muriel, is that you?"
The girl turned the receiver slightly away from her ear.
"Yes, mother."
"How are you?" she said.
"I've been worried to death about you. Why haven't you phoned? Are you all right?"
"I tried to catch you last night and the night before. The phone here has been..."
"Are you all right, Muriel?"
The girl increased the angle between the receiver and her ear.
"I'm fine. I'm hot. This is the hottest day they've had in Florida, and why haven't you called me? I've been worried to..."
"Mother, darling, don't yell at me. I can hear you beautifully," said the girl. "I called you twice last night. Once just after..."
"I told your father you'd probably called last night, but no, he had to..." "Are you all right, Muriel? Tell me the truth."
"I'm fine. Stop asking me that, please."
"When did you get there?"
"I don't know. Wednesday morning. Early."
"Who drove?"
"He did," said the girl. "And don't get excited. He drove very nicely. I was amazed."
"He drove? Muriel, you gave me your word of..."
"Mother," the girl interrupted, "I just told you. He drove very nicely. Under 50 the whole way, as a matter of fact."
"Did he try any of that funny business with the trees?"
"I said he drove very nicely, Mother. Now, please. I asked him to stay close to the white line and all, and he knew what I meant, and he did. He was even trying not to look at the trees. You could tell."
"Did Daddy get the car fixed, incidentally?" "Not yet. They want $400 just to..."
"Mother, Seymour told Daddy that he'd pay for it. There's no reason for..."
"Well, we'll see. How did he behave in the car and all?"
"All right," said the girl.
"Did he keep calling you that awful?"
"No. He has something to do now."
"What?"
"Oh, what's the difference, Mother?"
"Muriel, I want to know. Your father..."
"All right, all right. He calls me Miss Spiritual Tramp of 1948, the girl said, and giggled.
"It isn't funny, Muriel. It isn't funny at all. It's horrible. It's sad, actually. When I think how..."
"Mother," the girl interrupted, "listen to me. You remember that book he sent me from Germany? You know those German poems? What'd I do with it? I've been racking my..."
"You have it."
"Are you sure?" said the girl.
"Certainly. That is, I have it. It's in Freddy's room. You left it here and I didn't have room for it in the..." "Why? Does he want it?"
"No. Only he asked me about it when we were driving down. He wanted to know if I'd read it."
"It was in German. Yes, dear. It doesn't make any difference, said the girl, crossing her legs. Excuse me. He said that the poems happened to be written by the only great poet of the century. He said I should have bought a translation or something, or learn the language, if you please. Awful. Awful. It's sad, actually, is what it is. Your father said last night, just a second, mother, the girl said. She went over to the window seat for her cigarettes, lit one, and returned to her seat on the bed. Mother, she said, exhaling smoke. Muriel, now you listen to me. I'm listening. Your father talked to Dr. Savetsky. Oh, said the girl. He told him everything. At least, he said he did. You know your father. The trees, that business with the window, those horrible things he said to Granny about her plants from passing away, what he did with all those lovely pictures from Bermuda, everything. Well, said the girl. Well, in the first place, he said it was a perfect crime the army released him from the hospital. My word of honor. He very definitely told your father there's a chance, a very great chance, he said, that Seymour may completely lose control of himself. My word of honor. There's a psychiatrist here at the hotel, said the girl. Who? What's his name? I don't know. Reiser or something. He's supposed to be very good. Never heard of him. Well, he's supposed to be very good anyway. Muriel, don't be fresh, please. We're very worried about you. Your father wanted to wire you last night to come home. As a matter of fact, I'm not coming home right now, Mother, so relax. Muriel, my word of honor, Dr. Savetsky said Seymour may completely lose control. I just got here, Mother. This is the first vacation I've had in years, and I'm not going to just pack everything and come home, said the girl. I couldn't travel now anyway. I'm so sunburned I can hardly move. You're badly sunburned? Didn't you use that jar of bronze I put in your bag? I put it right. I used it. I'm burned anyway. That's terrible. Where were you burned? All over, dear. All over. That's terrible. I'll live. Tell me, did you talk to this psychiatrist? Well, sort of, said the girl. What'd he say? Where was Seymour when you talked to him? In the ocean room, playing the piano. He's played the piano both nights we've been here. Well, what'd he say? Oh, nothing much. He spoke to me first. I was sitting next to him at bingo last night, and he asked me if that wasn't my husband playing the piano in the other room. I said, yes, it was. And he asked me if Seymour's been sick or something. So I said, why'd he ask that? I don't know, Mother. I guess because he's so pale and all, said the girl. Anyway, after bingo, he and his wife asked me if I wouldn't like to join them for a drink. So I did. His wife was horrible. You remember that awful dinner dress we saw in Bonwit's window? The one you said you'd have to have a tiny? The green? She had it on. And all hips. She kept asking me if Seymour's related to that Suzanne glass that has that place on Madison Avenue. The millinery? What'd he say, though? The doctor? Oh, well, nothing much, really. I mean, we were in the bar and all. It was terribly noisy. Yes, but did you tell him what he tried to do with Granny's chair? No, Mother. I didn't go into details very much, said the girl. I'll probably get a chance to talk to him again. He's in the bar all day long. Did he say he thought there was a chance he might get, you know, funny or anything? Do something to you? Well, not exactly, said the girl. He had to have more facts, Mother. They have to know about your childhood, all that stuff. I told you we could hardly talk. It was so noisy in there. Well, how's your blue coat? All right. I had some of the padding taken out. How are the clothes this year? Terrible. But out of this world. You see sequins, everything, said the girl. How's your room? All right. Just all right, though. We couldn't get the room we had before the war, said the girl. The people are awful this year. You should see what sits next to us in the dining room, at the next table. They look as if they drove down in a truck. Well, it's that way all over. How's your ballerina?
It's too long. I told you it was too long.
Muriel, I'm only going to ask you once more. Are you really all right?
Yes, Mother, said the girl for the 90th time.
And you don't want to come home?
No, Mother.
Your father said last night that he'd be more than willing to pay for it if you'd go away someplace by yourself to think things over. You could take a lovely cruise. We both thought...
No thanks, said the girl, and uncrossed her legs. Mother, this call is costing a fortune.
When I think of how you waited for that boy all through the war, I mean, when you think of all those crazy little wives who...
Mother, said the girl, we better hang up. Seymour may come in any minute.
Where is he?
On the beach.
On the beach? By himself? Does he behave himself on the beach?
Mother, said the girl, you talk about him as though he were a raving maniac.
I said nothing of the kind, Muriel.
Well, you sound that way. I mean, all he does is lie there. He won't take his bathrobe off.
He won't take his bathrobe off? Why not?
I don't know. I guess because he's so pale.
My goodness, he needs the sun. Can't you make him?
You know Seymour, said the girl and crossed her legs again. He says he doesn't want a lot of fools looking at his tattoo.
He doesn't have any tattoo. Did he get one in the army?
No, Mother. No, dear, said the girl and stood up. Listen, I'll call you tomorrow, maybe.
Muriel, now listen to me.
Yes, Mother, said the girl, putting her weight on her right leg.
Call me the instant he does or says anything at all funny. You know what I mean. Do you hear me?
Mother, I'm not afraid of Seymour.
Muriel, I want you to promise me.
All right, I promise. Goodbye, Mother, said the girl. Might give my love to Daddy. And she hung up.
Seymour Glass,
said Sybil Carpenter, who was staying at the hotel with her mother.
Did you see more glass?
Pussycat, stop saying that. It's driving Mommy absolutely crazy. Hold still, please. Mrs. Carpenter was putting suntan oil on Sybil's shoulders, spreading it down over the delicate wing-like blades of her back. Sybil was sitting insecurely on a huge inflated beach ball facing the ocean. She was wearing a canary yellow two-piece bathing suit, one piece of which she would not actually be needing for another 9 or 10 years. It was really just an ordinary silk handkerchief. You could see when you got up close, said the woman in the beach chair beside Mrs. Carpenter's. I wish I knew how she tied it. It was really darling. It sounds darling, Mrs. Carpenter agreed. Sybil, hold still, pussy.
Did you see more glass?
Said Sybil. Mrs. Carpenter sighed. All right, she said. She replaced the cap on the suntan oil bottle.
Now run and play, pussy. Mommy's going up to the hotel and have a martini with Mrs. Hubble.
I'll bring you the olive, said Luce. Sybil immediately ran down to the flat part of the beach and began to walk in the direction of Fisherman's Pavilion. Stopping only to sink a foot in a soggy, collapsed castle, she was soon out of the area reserved for guests of the hotel. She walked for about a quarter of a mile and then suddenly broke into an oblique run up the soft part of the beach. She stopped short when she reached the place where a young man was lying on his back.
Are you going in the water, Seymour Glass? She said.
The young man started. His right hand going to the lapels of his terry cloth robe. He turned over on his stomach, letting a sausaged towel fall away from his eyes, and squinted up at Sybil.
Hey, hello, Sybil. Are you going in the water?
I was waiting for you, said the young man.
What's new?
What? Said Sybil.
What's new? What's on the program?
My daddy's coming tomorrow on an airplane, Sybil said, kicking sand.
Out of my face, baby, the young man said, putting his hand on Sybil's ankle.
Well, it's about time he got here, your daddy.
I've been expecting him hourly. Hourly. Where's the lady? Sybil said. The lady? The young man brushed some sand out of his thin hair. It's hard to say, Sybil. She may be in any one of a thousand places. At the hairdresser's, having her hair dyed mink, or making dolls for poor children in her room. Lying prone now, he made two fists, set one on top of the other, and rested his chin on the top one. Ask me something else, Sybil, he said. That's a fine bathing suit you have on. If there's one thing I like, it's a blue bathing suit. Sybil stared at him, then looked down at her protruding stomach.
This is yellow, she said. This is a yellow.
It is. Come a little closer. Sybil took a step forward. You're absolutely right. What a fool I am. Are you going in the water? Sybil said. I'm seriously considering it. I'm giving it plenty of thought, Sybil. You'll be glad to know. Sybil prodded the rubber float that the young man sometimes used as a headrest. It needs air, she said. You're right. It needs more air than I'm willing to admit. He took away his fists and let his chin rest on the sand. Sybil, he said, you're looking fine. It's good to see you. Tell me about yourself. He reached in front of him and took both of Sybil's ankles in his hands. I'm Capricorn, he said. What are you?
Sharon Lipschitz said, you let her sit on the piano seat with you, Sybil said.
Sharon Lipschitz said that? Sybil nodded vigorously. He let go of her ankles, drew in his hands, and laid the side of his face on his right forearm. Well, he said, you know how those things happen, Sybil. I was sitting there playing, and you were nowhere in sight, and Sharon Lipschitz came over and sat down next to me. I couldn't push her off. Could I?
Yes.
Oh, no, no, I couldn't do that, said the young man. I'll tell you what I did do, though.
What?
I pretended she was you. Sybil immediately stooped and began to dig in the sand.
Let's go in the water, she said.
All right, said the young man. I think I can work it in. Next time, push her off, Sybil said. Push who off?
Sharon Lipschitz.
Ah, Sharon Lipschitz, said the young man. How that name comes up, mixing memory and desire. He suddenly got to his feet. He looked at the ocean. Sybil, he said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll see if we can catch a banana fish.
A what?
A banana fish, he said, and undid the belt of his robe. He took off the robe. His shoulders were white and narrow, and his trunks were royal blue. He folded the robe, first lengthwise, then in thirds. He unrolled the towel he had used over his eyes, spread it out on the sand, and then laid the folded robe on top of it. He bent over, picked up the float, and secured it under his right arm. Then, with his left hand, he took Sybil's hand. The two started to walk down to the ocean. I imagine you've seen quite a few banana fish in your day, the young man said. Sybil shook her head. You haven't? Where do you live, anyway? I don't know, said Sybil. Sure you know. You must know. Sharon Lipschitz knows where she lives, and she's only 3 1/2. Sybil stopped walking and yanked her hand away from him. She picked up an ordinary beach shell and looked at it with elaborate interest. She threw it down.
Whirlywood, Connecticut, she said, and resumed walking, stomach foremost.
Whirlywood, Connecticut, said the young man. Is that anywhere near Whirlywood, Connecticut, by any chance? Sybil looked at him.
That's where I live, she said impatiently. I live in Whirlywood, Connecticut.
She ran a few steps ahead of him, caught up her left foot in her left hand, and hopped 2 or 3 times.
You have no idea how clear that makes everything, the young man said.
Sybil released her foot.
Did you read Little Black Sambo? She said.
It's very funny you ask me that, he said.
It so happens I just finished reading it last night. He reached down and took back Sybil's hand. What did you think of it? He asked her. Did the tigers run all around that tree?
I thought they'd never stop. I never saw so many tigers.
There are only six, said Sybil.
Only six, said the young man. Do you call that only?
Do you like wax? Sybil asked.
Do I like what? Asked the young man.
Wax.
Very much. Don't you?
Sybil nodded. Do you like olives? She asked.
Olives? Yes. Olives and wax. I never go any place without them.
Do you like Sharon Lipschitz? Sybil asked.
Why, yes. Yes, I do, said the young man. What I like particularly about her is that she never does anything mean to little dogs in the lobby of the hotel. That little toy bull that belongs to that lady from Canada, for instance. You probably won't believe this, but some little girls like to poke that little dog with balloon sticks. Sharon doesn't. She's never mean or unkind. That's why I like her so much. Sybil was silent.
I like to chew candles, she said finally.
Who doesn't? Said the young man, getting his feet wet. Wow, it's cold. He dropped the rubber float on its back. No, wait just a second, Sybil. Wait till we get out a little bit. They waded out till the water was up to Sybil's waist. Then the young man picked her up and laid her down on her stomach on the float. Don't you ever wear a bathing cap or anything? He asked.
Don't let go, Sybil ordered. You hold me now.
Miss Carpenter, please. I know my business, the young man said. You just keep your eyes open for any banana fish. This is a perfect day for a banana fish.
I don't see any, Sybil said.
Well, that's understandable. Their habits are very peculiar. He kept pushing the float. The water was not quite up to his chest. They lead a very tragic life, he said. Do you know what they do, Sybil? She shook her head. Well, they swim into a hole where there's a lot of bananas. They're very ordinary-looking fish when they swim in. But once they get in, they behave like pigs. Why, I've known some banana fish to swim into a banana hole and eat as many as 78 bananas. He edged the float and its passenger a foot closer to the horizon. Naturally, after they're so fat, they can't get out of the hole again. Can't fit through the door.
Not too far out, Sybil said. What happens to them?
What happens to who?
The banana fish.
Oh, you mean after they eat so many bananas, they can't get out of the banana hole?
Yes, said Sybil.
Well, I hate to tell you, Sybil, they die.
Why? Asked Sybil.
Well, they get banana fever. It's a terrible disease.
Here comes a wave, Sybil said nervously.
We'll ignore it. We'll snub it, said the young man. Two snobs. He took Sybil's ankles in his hands and pressed down and forward. The float nosed over the top of the wave. The water soaked Sybil's blonde hair, but her scream was full of pleasure. With her hand, when the float was level again, she wiped away a flat, wet band of hair from her eyes and reported,
I just saw one.
Saw what, my love?
A banana fish.
My God, no, said the young man. Did he have any bananas in his mouth?
Yes, said Sybil, six.
The young man suddenly picked up one of Sybil's wet feet, which were drooping over the end of the float, and kissed the arch.
Hey, she said, the owner of the foot, turning around.
Hey, yourself. We're going in now. You had enough?
No.
Sorry, he said, and pushed the float toward the shore until Sybil got off it. He carried it the rest of the way.
Goodbye, said Sybil, and ran without regret in the direction of the hotel.
The young man put on his robe, closed the lapels tight, and jammed his towel into his pocket. He picked up the slimy, wet, cumbersome float and put it under his arm. He plodded alone through the soft, hot sand toward the hotel. On the sub-main floor of the hotel, which the management directed bathers to use, a woman with zinc salve on her nose got into the elevator with the young man. "I see you're looking at my feet," he said to her when the car was in motion. "I beg your pardon," said the woman. "I said, I see you're looking at my feet." "I beg your pardon. I happen to be looking at the floor," said the woman, and then faced the doors of the car. "If you want to look at my feet, say so," said the young man. "But don't be a goddamn sneak about it." "Let me out here, please," the woman said quickly to the girl operating the car. The car doors opened and the woman got out without looking back. "I have two normal feet and I can't see the slightest goddamn reason why anybody should stare at them," said the young man. "5, please." He took his room key out of his robe pocket. He got off at the 5th floor, walked down the hall, and let himself into 507. The room smelled of new calfskin luggage and nail lacquer remover. He glanced at the girl, lying asleep on one of the twin beds. Then he went over to one of the pieces of luggage, opened it, and from under a pile of shorts and undershirts, he took out an Ortgies, caliber 7.65, automatic. He released the magazine, looked at it, then reinserted it. He cocked the piece. Then he went over and sat down on the unoccupied twin bed, looked at the girl, aimed a pistol, and fired a bullet right through his right temple. There you have it. J.D. Salinger's infamous story from 1948. A perfect day for banana fish. I don't know, I don't like to editorialize, but anyways. Just in case anybody's wondering from my cryptic post, this is not a personal impulse I have at the moment. Although I have had it in the past. I kind of want to talk about it, but I don't really know how to talk about it, because this kind of thing has plagued me for many years, and not the desire, just like it happening around me, but I guess the desire did plague me too for many years, but then once I got over it, it hasn't really bothered me. So I don't know. If you know anybody who's feeling really low, be a friend. Listen, if you can. I don't know about the professional help thing. I kind of don't like the professionals, but I would like to say that there's a some like kind of communal solution, but clearly there isn't. It's every man for himself now, which is probably the problem. I should have looked it up. There's a really good episode of the Moth podcast where this guy talks about what finally worked or helped him on the road to alleviating his depression. But it isn't really a solution that's available to most people living in the West. In short, he goes to Africa and pays for someone to do a ritual for him. And there's a part of it he says that in seeking the ritual, he like met some people, this woman from Rwanda in the village, and he was like, they were talking about the depression after all the genocide, massacring, and everything that was going on there. And he said the Rwandan woman said to him, like, you know, he asked about, like, all the Western aid workers, you know, and how that worked out to help people with their, quote-unquote, PTSD after the genocide. And the Rwandan said, well, they did a funny thing. They would take people into a small dark room and they would get them to talk about what made them sad. This is a very bad idea. What these people needed was not a small dark room with people talking about sadness. What they needed was a love and camaraderie of friends. So we had to ask them to leave. Anyways, I've done a really poor job butchering, paraphrasing that podcast, and I wish I could find it. Maybe I'll post a link to it somewhere on social media one of these days. So I don't know if you're familiar with J.D. Salinger. I think he was canceled for some reason. But anyways, not that canceling is like a great solution. I don't know. I think the great solution for like everything is that like people just love each other, you know? But I know it's hard and I know everybody's an individual, thinks they are, even though science says otherwise. But nobody really knows anything about science, least of all the scientists. But it does get weaponized a lot, little tidbits that people pull out of it. I guess I pull out the little quantum theory tidbits that say that it's impossible for us to be separate individuals, and that it's a foolish idea, and that it's a cultural construct that came about thanks to the Vienna School, which was actually debunked by Gödel way back in the early 20th century, but because the Vienna Circle are the ones who led the academics intellectual charge against metaphysics, but Gödel proved metaphysics is in fact physics, and the quantum physicists have been doing the same thing ever since. But instead, people talk about things like that separate them, like gender and race and all this kind of stuff. When we're all people, we all have the same blood. If your heart falls out and you need another one, or if you need another organ, you know, it doesn't matter what skin color the person is. I guess what does matter is blood type in a lot of cases, but everyone, you don't know what type of blood they have based on the way that they look or who they fuck, or how much money they have or don't have. But I don't know. I guess, you know, those things are important to a lot of people. Nobody wants to forget their quote-unquote heritage, their national heritage, even though their actual heritage is just, you know, Mother Earth. Not necessarily Adam and Eve, but a few hominids that were hanging around a long time ago. We all got that blood, however a physical weird snowflake, I mean not in the current politically charged definition of snowflake, but in the idea of the snowflake when you're a little kid, you know, like every snowflake is different, you know, they're all unique, every snowflake is different, like all those millions of snowflakes. And it's true, all of us are like different, just like all those snowflakes looking, but technically we're all snowflakes, scientifically speaking. We're all humans. There's only one race, the human race. And there are no individuals. There's uniqueness, but no separateness. So anyways, I don't know. I don't know what to say about any of this stuff. Why my friends and me and everybody thinks killing themselves is a solution or killing somebody else. But Salinger, in all his, like, incorrectness, did attempt to tackle the subject a couple of times. So 10 years later, he wrote this story, which I will not have time to complete, but it's ostensibly a story called Seymour, An Introduction, which is supposedly being told by his brother, Buddy Glass, about Seymour, who killed himself 10 years earlier. Seymour, An Introduction. The actors, by their presence, always convince me, to my horror, that most of what I've written about them until now is false. It is false because I write about them with steadfast love. Even now, while I write it down, this too becomes false. But varying ability. And this varying ability does not hit off the real actors loudly and correctly, but loses itself dully in this love that will never be satisfied with the ability, and therefore thinks it is protecting the actors by preventing this ability from exercising itself. It is, to describe it figuratively, as if an author were to make a slip of the pen, and as if this clerical error became conscious of being such. Perhaps this was no error, but in a far higher sense was an essential part of the whole exposition. It is then as if this clerical error were to revolt against the author out of hatred for him, were to forbid him to correct it, and were to say, no, I will not be erased. I will stand as a witness against thee that thou art a very poor writer. That's Salinger's little preamble to Seymour. His little introduction to Seymour, An Introduction. At times, frankly, I find it pretty slim picking. But at the age of 40, I look on my old fair-weather friend, the general reader, as my last deeply contemporary confidant. And I was rather strenuously requested, long before I was out of my teens, by at once the most exciting and the least fundamentally bumptious public craftsman I've ever personally known, to try to keep a steady and sober regard for the amenities of such a relationship, be it ever so peculiar or terrible. In my case, he saw it coming on from the first. The question is, how can a writer observe the amenities if he has no idea what his general reader is like? The reverse is common enough, most certainly, but just when is the author of a story ever asked what he thinks the reader is like? Very luckily, to push on and make my point here, and I don't think it's the kind of point that will survive an interminable build-up. I found out a good many years back practically all I need to know about my general reader, that is to say you, I'm afraid. You'll deny it up and down, I suspect, but I'm really in no position to take your word for it. You're such a great bird lover, much like a man in a short story called School of Sketty by John Buchan, which Arnold L. Sugarman Jr. once pressed me to read during a very poorly supervised study hall period. You're someone who took up birds in the first place because they fired your imagination. They fascinated you because they seemed, of all the created beings, the nearest to pure spirit. Those little creatures with a normal temperature of 125 degrees. Probably just like this Buchan, John Buchan man, you thought many thrilling related thoughts. You reminded yourself, I don't doubt, that, quote, the goldcrest with a stomach no bigger than a bean flies across the North Sea. The curlew sandpiper, which breeds so far north that only about three people have ever seen its nest, goes to Tasmania for its holidays. It would be too much of a good thing to hope, of course, that my very own general reader should turn out to be one of the three people who have actually seen the curlew sandpiper's nest. But I feel, at least, that I know him, you, quite well enough to guess what kind of well-meant gesture might be welcomed from me right now. And this entrenew spirit then, old confidant, before we join the others, the grounded everywhere, including, I'm sure, the middle-aged hot rodders who insist on zooming us to the moon, the Dharma bums, the makers of cigarette filters for thinking men, the beat and the sloppy and the petulant, the chosen cultists, all the lofty experts who know so well what we should or shouldn't do with our poor little sex organs, all the bearded, proud, unlettered young men and unskilled guitarists and zen killers and incorporated aesthetic teddy boys who look down their thoroughly unenlightened noses at this splendid planet where, please don't shut me up, Kilroy, Christ, and Shakespeare all stopped. Before we join these others, I privately say to you, old friend, unto you really, I'm afraid, please accept from me this unpretentious bouquet of very early blooming parentheses, of which there are eight. I suppose, most unflorally, I truly mean them to be taken first off as bow-legged, buckle-legged omens of my state of mind and body at this writing, professionally speaking, which is the only way I've ever really enjoyed speaking up, and just to ingratiate myself still less, I speak nine languages incessantly, four of them stone dead. Professionally speaking, I repeat, I'm an occasionally happy man. I'm an ecstatically happy man. I've never been before. Oh, once perhaps, when I was 14, and wrote a story in which all the characters had Heidelberg dueling scars, the hero, the villain, the heroine, her old nanny, and all the horses and dogs. I was reasonably happy then, you might say, but not ecstatically, not like this. To the point, I happen to know, possibly none better, that an ecstatically happy writing person is often a totally draining type to have around. Of course, the poets in this state are by far the most difficult, but even the prose writer, similarly seized, hasn't any real choice of behavior in decent company. Divine or not, a seizure's a seizure. And while I think an ecstatically happy prose writer can do many good things on the printed page, the best things, I'm frankly hoping, it's also true and infinitely more self-evident, I fear, that he can't be moderate or temperate or brief. He loses very nearly all his short paragraphs. He can't be detached, or only very rarely and suspiciously, on downwards. In the wake of anything as large and consuming as happiness, he necessarily forfeits the much smaller but, for a writer, always rather exquisite pleasure of appearing on the page serenely sitting on a fence. Worst of all, I think he's no longer in a position to look after the reader's most immediate want, namely, to see the author get the hell on with the story. Hence, in part, That ominous offspring of parentheses a few sentences back. I'm aware that a good many perfectly intelligent people can't stand parenthetical comments while a story is purportedly being told. We're advised of these things by mail, mostly, granted, by thesis preparers with very natural, oaty urges to write us under the table in their off-campus time. But we read, and usually we believe, good or bad or indifferent, any string of English words holds our attention as if it came from Prospero himself. I'm here to advise that not only will my asides run rampant from this point on, I'm not sure, in fact, that there won't be a footnote or two, but I fully intend, from time to time, to jump up personally on the reader's back when I see something off the beaten plot line that looks exciting or interesting and worth steering toward. Speed here, God save my American hide, means nothing whatever to me. There are, however, readers who seriously require only the most restrained, most classical, and possibly deftest methods of having their attention drawn. And I suggest, as honestly as a writer can suggest this sort of thing, that they leave now, while I can imagine the leaving's good and easy. I'll probably continue to point out available exits as we move along, but I'm not sure I'll pretend to put my heart into it again. I'd like to start out with some rather unstinting words about those two opening quotations. The actors, by their presence, is from Kafka. The second one, it is, to describe it figuratively, as if an author were to make a slip of the pen, is from Kierkegaard. And it's all I can do to keep from unattractively rubbing my hands together at the thought that this particular Kierkegaard passage may catch a few existentialists and somewhat over-published French mandarins with their, well, by some little surprise, I don't know. I don't really deeply feel that anyone needs an airtight reason for quoting from the works of writers he loves, but it's always nice, I'll grant you, if he has one. In this case, it seems to me that these two passages, especially in contiguity, are wonderfully representative of the best, in a sense, not only of Kafka and Kierkegaard, but of all the four dead men. The four variously notorious sick men or under-adjusted bachelors, probably only Van Gogh of the four will be excused from making a guest appearance in these pages, whom I most often run to, occasionally in real distress, when I want any perfectly credible information about modern artistic processes. By and large, I've reproduced the two passages to try to suggest very plainly how I think I stand in regard to the overall mass of data I hope to assemble here, a thing that in some quarters I don't a bit mind saying an author can't be too explicit about, or any too early. In part, though, it would be rewarding for me to think, to dream, that these two short quotations may quite conceivably serve as a sort of spot convenience to the comparatively new breed of literary critics. The many workers, soldiers, I suppose you could say, who put in long hours, often with waning hopes of distinction, and are busy neo-Freudian arts and letters clinics. Especially perhaps those still very young students and greener clinicians themselves implicitly bursting with good mental health. Themselves, undeniably, I think, free of any inherent morbid attraction to beauty, who one day intend to specialize in aesthetic pathology. Admittedly, this is a subject I've felt flinty about since I was 11 years old and watched the artist and sick man I've loved most in this world then still in knee pants, being examined by a reputable group of professional Freudians for 6 hours and 45 minutes. In my not altogether reliable opinion, they stopped just short of taking a brain smear from him, and I've had an idea for 2 years. I've had an idea for years that only the latish hour, 2 a.m., dissuaded them from doing exactly that. Flinty, then, I do indeed mean to sound here. Curlish, no. I can perceive, though, that it's a very thin line or plank, but I'd like to try to walk it for a minute more. Ready or not, I've waited a good many years to collect these sentiments and get them off. A great variety of rumors, of course, run high and wide about the extraordinarily, the sensationally creative artist. And I'm alluding exclusively here to painters and poets and full dicta. One of these rumors, and by far to me the most exhilarating of the lot, is that he has never, even in the pre-psychoanalytical dark ages, deeply venerated his professional critics, and has, in fact, usually lumped them in his generally unsound views of society with the Escht publishers and art dealers and the other, perhaps enviably prosperous, camp followers of the arts who, he's just scarcely said to concede, would prefer different, possibly cleaner work if they could get it. But what, at least in modern times, I think one most recurrently hears about the curiously productive, though ailing, poet or painter is that he is invariably a kind of supersized but unmistakably quote-unquote classical neurotic, an aberrant who only occasionally and never deeply wishes to surrender his aberration, or in English, a sick man who not at all seldom, though he's reported to childishly deny it, gives out terrible cries of pain, as if he would wholeheartedly let go both his art and his soul to experience what passes in other people for wellness. And yet, the rumor continues, when his unsalutary-looking little room is broken into and someone, not infrequently at that, someone who actually loves him, passionately asks him where the pain is, he either declines or seems unable to discuss it at any constructive clinical length. And in the morning, when even great poets and painters presumably feel a bit more chipper than usual, he looks more perversely determined than ever to see his sickness run its course, as though by the light of another, presumably working day, he had remembered that all men, the healthy ones included, eventually die, and usually with a certain amount of bad grace, but that he, lucky man, is at least being done in by the most stimulating companion, disease or no, he has ever known. On the whole, treacherous as it may sound, coming from me, with just such a dead artist in the immediate family as I've been alluding to throughout this near polemic, I don't see how one can rationally deduce that this last general rumor and mouthful isn't based on a fairish amount of substantial fact. While my distinguished relative lived, I watched him almost literally, I sometimes think, like a hawk. By every logical definition, he was an unhealthy specimen. He did, on his worst nights and late afternoons, give out not only cries of pain, but cries for help. And when nominal help arrived, he did declined to say in perfectly intelligible language where it hurt. Even so, I do openly cavil that with the declared experts in these matters, the scholars, the biographers, and especially the current ruling intellectual aristocracy educated in one or another of the big public psychoanalytical schools, and I cavil with them most acrimoniously over this, they don't listen properly to cries of pain when they come. They can't, of course. They're a peerage, of 10 ears. With such faulty equipment, with those ears, how can anyone possibly trace the pain?